Why don't you explain the story of Iterix the Druid and then talk a little bit about the Apple Branch?
Oh, well, the story of Iterix the Druid was basically an illustration of the problems of living in a small culture that is strongly rooted in the land. And when it comes into contact with a large culture that is not specific to a particular land or country, that is simply based on the accumulation of power and material goods. Mm-hmm. And this sort of struggle for identity and for survival of one particular way of experiencing the world, as opposed to the sort of mega culture, what's called a muck world or world mart or whatever some people have called it, which is basically a way of trying to reduce everything to one single common denominator so that things are easier to control. And when you choose diversity, when you choose individuality, when you choose a particular viewpoint, you make yourself vulnerable because you're going against the grain of this large standardizing, simplifying process of empire, you know, that people who build empires are engaged in. And I'm showing how at different periods and in different places these forces have confronted each other. So Viderix is someone who lives originally in the first century of our era, at the time when the Romans destroyed the primary druidical sanctuary that was on the island of Mona, which is the island that's called Anglesey now, off the north coast of Wales. And in around 60 AD, there was a military campaign by the governor of Britain at that time, the Roman military governor, who was Suetonius Paulinus, and who decided to put an end to the Druids' power because they were the spiritual backbone of the Celtic world. They kept Celtic culture alive. They kept Celtic religion alive. They kept the sense of Celtic identity alive, prevented it from being that easily absorbed into
Roman society. And it's about the only centralized part of Celtic culture.
Exactly.
And the Romans always looking for the center.
Exactly. That was what made it all hold together when there was no political centralization of any kind. Celtic tribes are completely independent from each other. They didn't cooperate with each other. There was no institution that would have forced them to cooperate. The only cement that was holding them together was language and this type of religion, this type of poetic and theological tradition that they respected. And that was international in the sense that people from many different tribes could come together and study the same tradition. So the Romans tried to destroy that. So I portray Viderix as coming from this institution, this first flowering of the Celtic world, and escaping through time with the help of Celtic gods. And
good thing they were there.
Yes, good thing they were there and that he knew how to invoke them. But he is then forced to try and reassemble what made the cohesion of the Celtic world. And I portray that in the comic book as the device of the treasures of Britain. In Celtic mythology, we have this notion that society was originally held together by magical objects that represent the different functions that are necessary for the tribe to function correctly and to be properly in balance with the land. So I imagine these treasures as having originally existed in Mona. Again, that's a comic book thesis to hold the story together. And then they get scattered in time to prevent the Romans from getting them. But then they have to be reassembled. So Viderix is trying to reassemble them. And of course, the different tools, these different treasures, these different magical objects, wind up in different periods in different places. So he travels through time and space in order to obtain them. So this allows us to glimpse different periods of Celtic history. He goes into visits the island of Iona and the monastery there, sort of at the time when it was being attacked by the Vikings, and this whole flowering of Celtic Christianity was coming to an end. So that was another attempt at reintegrating the Celtic world and showing it how it's being destroyed again. But Viderix manages to save one aspect of it. And of course, he gains his first companion in his quest from that adventure. Then the third episode was supposed to take place in present-day Brittany. And it, I used...
Brittany is part of France.
Right. Well,
so to speak.
So to speak, right. It belongs politically to France, but it's a very different country. And I used as the background the anti-nuclear protests that played such an enormous role in Brittany around 1980, and use a person who was involved in those protests as the point of view character for that episode.
And it's really neat because, of course, Vitterix reacts to 20th century Brittany differently than, of course, we would. And of course, the monk from the 9th century also reacts differently. So so as you're reading Vitterix, you're getting the action through the points of view of different people coming at it from their own perspective and their own prejudices.
Right, but they're all form part of one single whole. Mm-hmm. That is, all of their experiences make up what has been Celtic history. And the sum total of those experiences still add up to what the Celtic identity is today. So that's...
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of science fiction uses Celtic themes, but they almost never take place in the 20th century.
No, because there's a... Again, it's part of our dominant culture's defensive reaction against these types of minority cultures that it has destroyed, is to say that they were great, they have a lot of romantic appeal, but they were in the past. They don't exist anymore. And you try and create as much distance as possible between the present-day situation and these other cultures with their other viewpoints, so that they're kept safely at a distance. They're not directly relevant to what's happening.
Well, I guess it's the equivalent of seeing a newspaper account of, say, the civil disobedience in Wall Street police plaza, and they call it vaguely reminiscent of the 60s, trying to sort of push that into the past.
Right.
Like, nobody's really protesting the police now. They're just sort of throwbacks to the 60s. Mm-hmm. It's just the same idea.
Yes, exactly.
You know, the Celts are just throwbacks to you know, 1,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in Vitterix, I was presenting everything from a Celtic point of view.
Yeah. And now in the Apple Branch, that's where you really go into detail. Tell us about what that book is about.
Well, that's, of course, a completely different thing because I was not... it's basically an attempt at educating people about what the Celtic world is, that there is an overarching reality behind what it has been historically through the ages. I'm presenting Celtic tradition, what has survived of Celtic tradition within communities that speak Celtic languages, as an alternative way of looking at the world, which I think is particularly important to people in Western civilization because it is a Western culture. It's not like taking, you know, Native Americans or people in the Pacific or whatever who have very different cultures and relate to the land in very different ways. But also, because they're in completely different parts of the world, they can very easily be misunderstood by Westerners who study them because their whole frame of reference is completely different. Whereas Celtic civilization does not have a totally different frame of reference. Mm. It evolved in the same geographical region as more dominant expressions of Western culture, and yet it looks at things completely differently. So being very much aware of the environmental crisis in which our planet is right now and the difficulty that our civilization has in coming to grips with it and doing anything concretely helpful about it, just basically moaning about what's happening, but then letting all of our institutional habits continue to contribute to the problem without really doing anything about them. I was saying, well, let's look at it from a completely different approach. Let's look at it from the point of view of a culture that was forced by its own economic circumstances, to have a very different attitude about nature, about its natural environment, and how through belief and ritual, it was constantly aware of the need of maintaining a balance between the needs of the human community and the reality of nature, of your physical environment. These are the concepts that in the Apple Branch I call tribe and land. Tribe is the human community. Humans have certain needs for a human society to be viable. It has to have certain conditions be met that permit people to live in a healthy environment, in a safe environment, in an environment that's stimulating and that allows people to feel comfortable about themselves and to look forward to something. So, yes, you know, you have to order your environment in some way so that the random forces of nature don't wipe you out. You have to have some form of technological way of making yourself safe. But at the same time, you can't forget that you're not isolated from nature. You're not isolated from this planet. You're not pure spirits that are living in a dead material framework, that you're actually a part of a much larger structure, and you fit inside that structure. You're not outside it. And when you're dependent on your physical environment completely, when you know that the food that you eat, the shelter that you get is dependent on cycles in nature, that certain conditions have to be met in relation to nature, adapting to nature for your survival to be assured.
There's no cycles in nature, just go to the supermarket.
But that's what happens now. If you live in a culture where that's clear, that you depend on the cycles of nature, then you're forced to create different attitudes to accommodate, to make yourself aware of those natural cycles all the time. And you do this through myth and ritual, which are constantly adjusting your way of looking at things so that you don't fall into the trap that our civilization has fallen into, because we had sort of technological windfalls that allowed us to control our environment according to our whims to an unbalanced degree, so that, like you just said, we no longer realize that our food has to come out of the land. We think that it comes out of the supermarket, and it's the problem of the people who grow it to get it to us.
Right. You know, that's their problem.
It's not our problem. Yeah. Right. And we've conditioned ourselves to have this notion that we no longer have to relate to the land directly. We have created this cocooned environment that is purely human, that is completely developed by human culture, and that no longer has any reference to the cycles of nature, or to the specificity of the place that you're in.